Welcome to Political Rewind. I am Bill Nygut. Glad to have you all with us here for the start of a new week. Before we get into the substance of the conversation today, I want to remind you all we're going to be heading to Savannah. Jim Galloway, who's here in the studio with me right now, and I are going to go down there to co-host, essentially, the Political Rewind in front of the live audience that the League of Women Voters of Coastal Georgia is putting together to come see us do the show.
And this is going to be fun.
I think it is. We've got our panel put together now. Jim and I will be joined first by Susan Catron, who's the editor of Savannah News. She'll have a lot to say about local stories down in Savannah that have statewide implications. Eric Johnson, former Republican state senator, candidate for governor, maybe one of the last South Georgia candidates to really make a big impact in a statewide race, especially governor's race. It'll be fun to talk to him about the future for politicians in South Georgia in that regard. And then former Senator Al Scott went on to become labor commissioner and now is the county chair down there in Chatham. So it's a really good panel.
Right, right. I mean, local,
yep.
State,
yep.
A little bit of federal.
Oh, we'll have it all.
Oh, so, it's shutdown day, too. After the shutdown.
We are going to record on Thursday evening and then air the show on Friday afternoon. If you want to come, go to gpb.org/community, and you'll get all the information you need about where the event is taking place, how you can register. There's no charge, but we'd like to know, or the League of Women Voters would like to know, if you plan on attending. Okay. That's our business for the day. Jim Galloway, the lead political writer for the AJC. We're glad, of course, to have you here. Your column appears on Wednesdays and Sundays. And you oversee the Political Insider blog as part of Politically Georgia on the MyAJC website. It's like Russian dolls.
Right. I'm looking for a Wednesday column. So if you got one out there, holler at me.
All right. Melita Easters, the founder and director of the Georgia Win List, which is dedicated to identifying and supporting women who want to run on the Democratic ticket who are pro-choice females, right?
Absolutely, and thank you for having me.
Sure, we're glad to have you back, Melita. And it's Monday, which means we have our friend Heath Garrett. He is a Republican strategist. Always, Heath, when I think of you as having been associated with Senator Johnny Isaacson for so many years. And I think he probably remains the politician, the political leader who you are most closely identified with, isn't he?
Absolutely. And it's he really enjoyed being here on Friday, and I'm glad to be here on Monday.
He was here on the show on Friday, and we're actually going to take a listen to a couple of things he had to say to us and then talk about him. Jim, though, let's start. We have some breaking news. We've had a lot of controversy really off and on for more than one session, a session and a half, I think you can say, over efforts to pass what everybody talks about as a clean adoption bill, a bill, number one, that does not have language that refers to whether private organizations can be exempted from adopting children to gay and lesbian couples. And then there's more to it than just that. But now we have a compromise, and the bill is on its way to the governor for signature.
Right. The House passed it last Thursday. The Senate delayed until today. They came back, and right about noon, they finally voted it out. I think 58-3, 58-2. It was an overwhelming vote. The two big elements that are contained that were controversial is, of course, there was the portion pushed by Casey Cagle that allows church-based private organizations to create a kind of a private child foster care system that has very limited oversight by the state. And then the other change that was really roiled over the weekend was the provision which was pushed by the House to permit adoptions by private attorneys. Those adoptions to allow birth mothers to be awarded living expenses in those cases. Previously, only adoption agencies, the larger organizations, were allowed to do that.
And the problem that some had was that it was like baby selling was the
accusation among critics. That's what they said. The latter would cause. There was a fear from David Schaefer that it would create kind of a bidding war, which hasn't shown up in other states that permit these kinds of practices. And quite frankly, there was an element of turf protection, because child placement agencies pretty much had a lock on any difficult adoption where the birth mother was running into problems, and there was money involved.
So Melita, for almost 2 years now, they fought down there, the House, because it was their bill initially, to make it easier for people to adopt children, because we have such a backlog of children in foster care in this state. Yeah,
absolutely, and it's really a credit to some of those who persisted to get the bill passed. Wendy Clifton is one of the lobbyists who really worked very, very hard on the bill, and Mary Margaret Oliver and others who...
And Bert Reeves.
Yes.
Don't forget Bert.
They persisted and kept at it, and I guess over the weekend they worked out the football coach adoption problem.
Oh, did they? Tell me how.
Well, no, did they? I'm asking you, Jim.
Explain what that means.
Well, there was some concern that the bill would create this big loophole that allowed temporary custody to be assigned to football coaches who needed a star player. And I don't know how that finally worked out, Jim.
They didn't touch that. I think there was a feeling that let's wait for the problem to jump up.
Let me back up, and it's... That the football coach amendment, essentially, as you call it, is a larger amendment, right? What it really is about is whether mothers should have the right to temporarily give up custody of their children if they're in hard circumstances, if they're struggling in some way. And I think at one point it was for, Heath, you're nodding, as much as a year, but then reclaim their children.
And, that's right.
And there were concerns just about that on the face of it. But then there's what Melita's talking about, this notion that maybe a school system looking to recruit a star athlete could use that to have the kid come play for them.
Absolutely. And there's anecdotal evidence, right, that this has happened at times in Georgia, usually for a good reason, right? Usually it's the coach taking a child who's now parentless or something, who's already there, and adopting them. The question was, could this become a recruiting tool? And in a football-loving state, anything can become a football recruiting
tool. I have a personal interest in this, because my daughter, who lives in Oregon, is a foster parent, in addition to the four biological children she has. And Georgia's laws desperately needed to be cleaned up, and it'll be wonderful to have this bill signed by the governor and move forward if that's possible.
Well, Jim, two things. Number one, it is Georgia. Everything comes back to football.
Of course.
And second, this cleans up what was a really messy, messy fight. The governor, the speaker, had said from the very start and before the start of the session, they wanted this taken care of and get that clean bill through.
It brought the legislature to a screeching halt last year, and then the first thing out of the gate this year, the Senate takes action on the bill, but they throw in the foster care element that the governor had vetoed the previous spring.
Okay. So the governor gets to sign this bill and move forward, and they can now fight over other matters, and we'll talk about some of those as the session moves on.
And, Bill, I do think that it is of note, when you talk about criminal justice reform and now adoption, you know, these are not traditional issues that you think of by Republican-led legislatures in the Deep South and red states, right? So it does show that there's still this practical element to Governor Deal and Speaker Ralston, and now an up and rising star like Bert Reeves, that they're willing to get their hands dirty in the legislative process, compromise, work with Democrats like Mary Margaret Oliver and other folks to actually move the ball down the field, so to speak, in the legislative process on issues that do not score in the top 20 in Republican primaries. And so I think it's a fascinating lesson for future Republicans in the state to think about good policy and makes good politics.
All right. Let's move on. We started on Friday, really, Jim, to talk about the fact we've just come to the end of a financial disclosure period for candidates in all levels of the state ballot, constitutional officers, PSC, congressional races as well. And Jim, you guys had a headline at Political Insider. We're now talking about $10 million right now in the governor's race.
And we've just started.
We've just begun.
We're still 4 months away from a primary.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, I think you saw a little bit of that in the late fall last year when the state Senate seat, you had a $500,000 race in Cobb County. The price of winning anywhere in Georgia has gone up exponentially.
And of course, you've got Stacey Abrams on the Democratic side, who has really nationalized her campaign for governor. So she's getting, I think she reported $1.7 million raised.
This period. $2.2 million total.
And let's see what she's got in the bank. She hasn't filed, we haven't seen her report yet. But that has really upped the ante she's following John Ossoff's lead.
Yeah.
Well, but even in the Public Service Commission, Lindy Miller is going to report $250,000 for a public service commission race. Mm-hmm. We've got a state Senate woman, Zara Karinchek, who will have $135,000 for a state Senate race in an early reporting. A House candidate, Lucy McBath, with $100,000 for a House seat in Cobb County to oppose Republican.
What do you think? Is that Donald Trump opening Democratic wallets?
I think the idea of resisting Trump has definitely opened Democratic wallets. I also believe that women are inspired by the Me Too movement to put their money where their mouth is to correct past wrongs.
Heath, why don't you weigh in on that, as a matter of fact? Is it Trump, the Trump effect? Democrats are excited, and they're going to go out there and do everything they can to elect Democrats?
I don't disagree with Melita. The Me Too movement has something to do with it, but I really have assessed this as both Donald Trump and resistance to Donald Trump. Donald Trump, for the left, has become what Barack Obama was for the right, an absolute straight person, straight man, kind of you can go up and pit up against and absolutely raise money, raise energy levels, excitement levels in the Democratic Party. And we as Republicans have got to pay attention to that and note it. The other thing is that these are districts and areas where there's a belief now on the Democratic side that Georgia is in play in the next couple of election cycles, definitely in some of these House and Senate races this cycle. But I think a lot of this is looking to 2020, 2022, where if we go purely, if demographics are destiny, then the Republican Party can't just be a white party in the future. And so I think some of that's coming to play here, and it's created excitement on the Democratic side that we haven't seen in a decade.
So I want to mention, let me take a shot at a different race here. The 6th Congressional District, which last year we know in the special election set a record for the most money raised in a congressional race, $40-plus million. It's interesting that Karen Handel, the incumbent who won that election, she raised $261,000. She's got about $600,000 cash on hand. Bobby Capel, who is a declared Democratic candidate, he's a former anchor reporter for CBS 46, has raised $255,000. Now, some of that is a loan, but my point being, Jim, this is not going to be a $40 million race.
Right, and you've got Kevin Abel in there with another $200,000.
Yes.
Well, I mean, people forget that with the exception of last year's contest, Karen Handel does not have a reputation as a fierce fundraiser.
Right,
and some a lot of politicians on both sides of the aisle are uncomfortable with that. But I think what you've got is, I would say that this is, if you've got two Democrats here raising almost $500,000, I think that's a good signal that you're not going to see John Ossoff make a repeat trip.
Yeah, I think that's probably correct.
Go ahead. His mother over the weekend sent some subtle signs that he hasn't made his decision yet by telling his supporters to keep the yard signs in a Facebook post.
Ooh.
And does he live in the district?
He does live in the district.
I
just want to make sure we got it.
All right. I want to play something for you because it caught our attention, as it did the AJC's. Clay Tippins, a Republican businessman who's kind of surprised everybody by jumping into the race. He's had no political background whatsoever. But he sees this as a time when people are looking at business folks to run for office. He actually released his first TV. He became the first candidate, Jim, to run a TV spot. He bought like $250,000 as a local spot in the Super Bowl.
Super Bowl time, yeah.
All right, let's listen. This commercial, we're going to truncate it because some of it relies on visuals that aren't going to make any sense to you listening. But what we've done is edited it in such a way that you will hear the talking points, his rationale that we expect to hear throughout the campaign for why he's running. Here's Clay Tippins, an edited version of the ad.
George's Clay Tippins likes to swim. Was nation's top high school swimmer. Swimming scholarship to Stanford, won 3 national championships. Clay's mission-focused upbringing led him to becoming a Navy SEAL. Served his years, volunteered for more. Clay returned home to high tech, where he built a multinational $500 million business.
Georgia is the greatest state in America, but why can't all of our children read? Why is Atlanta still the sex trafficking capital of the country? Why are we still running government pretty much the same way we did 50 years ago? A 21st century Georgia needs a 21st century governor.
He's no politician. He's real. Georgia's conservative Republican, Clay Tippins.
Jim, what people couldn't see are the visual shots that this commercial takes at all of his Republican opponents. Produced by Fred Davis.
Yes, we know him. We know him for he ran all the David Perdue and Sonny Perdue ads.
Yes, he did. And Melita Easter, since you were involved with the Roy Barnes administration and campaign, he also made his mark on Georgia in a big way when he worked for Sonny Perdue, and he did a infamous spot about Roy Barnes, the incumbent, in which he painted him as King Rat.
That was a low blow.
But it worked.
It did work.
It was a low blow that caught on.
And I'd have to refresh my memory on the visual, but, you know, there's always the law against wearing helmets when you're in a campaign. I'm wondering how the law applies to Speedos. But here, there are a couple of words that really stood out for me here. The use of the word real. Clay Tippins is real. Who was the last guy to use that? Oh, that was
Governor Deal.
Yeah. Oh, good.
And it just, but other than that, reading, sex trafficking, and a 21st century Georgia, this guy is still trying to find the issues that are going to make his way into it. Yeah.
Sex trafficking is not an issue that the Republican Party typically talks about in a gubernatorial campaign, however.
No, and I think this, the Clay Tippins campaign kind of is basing on a couple of things. They're clearly going to run as an outsider, not a politician. That's the textbook. They do think that the resume there is different. Stanford swimmer, Navy SEAL, tech executive, again, not a politician. And the question is, how do they juxtapose that to the current field and get traction in a Republican primary? And so I think that that's the real challenge. He's definitely going back to the Fred Davis playbook. This is very textbook. The question is, how many times is it going to work? It reminds people of the David Perdue ad with the crying babies a little bit and the rat ad. Some in the Republican side kind of view this as a Hail Mary. If there's not enough money in that campaign to back this up, you know, David Perdue put an ad up and then had $5 million or so of his own money that campaigned, and there's a question about whether or not they can sustain it. But is it a calculated risk? And I think there's some distinctions. The rat ad, I'm not sure it really worked as well as everybody gives credit for it. You know, Governor Barnes had just created such a backlash that Sonny Perdue captured that more so than actually.
Absolutely. Absolutely. All right, before we take a break, one more note from the governor's race. Jim, a Stacey Abrams campaign memo has come to light. Revealing
entirely accidental.
It was a well-placed leak of information. Would that be a way you'd say that?
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
So here are some of the highlights. And Jim, please weigh in on others. The Abrams campaign expects black voters to account for about 65% of the Democratic primary electorate, and that black women will make up the plurality at about 45%. The campaign says that Abrams beats Evans in all demographics and geographic groups in polling. They claim they've reached already 600,000 voters by phone, text, or door, and that they've signed up about 4,000 campaign volunteers. And they think that they've got a structural advantage. I assume that means boots on the ground advantage over Stacey Evans. Does that sum it up?
Yeah, with a couple of additions. Number one, it seems as if she's going to start pushing back, and Melita can speak to this, to the kind of the two Stacey's meme that right now the primary Democratic primary for governor is using Stacey Evans and Stacey Abrams as she calls it racially reductive.
Yeah.
And then,
I don't understand what that means.
That means you're simplifying it to the point that it's only black or white.
Okay.
And then the interesting thing is the presence of she's noting the presence of Vincent Fort as candidate for lieutenant governor. Now here's the triangulation you have to make here. Okay, Stacey Evans is from Smyrna. She's got the support of Roy Barnes. I'm pretty sure.
Oh, absolutely.
And Vincent Fort was a candidate in the mayoral race, former state senator. He too was backed by
Barnes.
Roy Barnes.
Yeah.
Okay, so you ask yourself, why is Vincent Fort in this race? Stacey Abrams thinks that she's going to be a stalking horse for Evans, making the African American attack on Stacey Abrams.
Whoa.
Well, certainly Vincent Fort's numbers in the mayor's race would not lead most people to believe they should launch a statewide campaign. Further,
he won 10% of the vote, basically.
Well, and that really makes you feel like he should run statewide. Sarah Riggs Amico, who is running for lieutenant governor as a businesswoman, had a very impressive turnout at her kickoff event last week. Mm-hmm. And I don't believe that Vincent Fort would have much of a chance against a woman so well-spoken and eloquent who can bring in the Teamster and union vote because
she runs a trucking company.
She runs a trucking company and has paid not just for her employee but for their family's health benefits. And so she has a very compelling story about being a businesswoman and providing health care for her workers.
All right, Heath, you get the last word in this segment.
Well, no, I think it's very fascinating to see the Vincent Fort stuff playing out. There's definitely the Barnes camp in the background, and I really think that everybody ought to pay attention to both Stacey Evans and this lieutenant gubernatorial candidate, Miko, because you could have two self-funders at the top of the ticket for the Democratic Party, both women. And that's what I'm looking for in these reports. How much are they loaning their campaigns, and how much will they put in? Because that could change things come November.
All right, we got to get a break in. And when we come back, we're going to be moving our focus toward the end of the week when we've got another spending deadline approaching, possible government shutdown. We'll talk a bit about the Nunes memo. Lots of national news to get into. Let's take a break. You're listening to Political Rewind.
Peter Sagal here, and if you're in your car, I want you to try something. Roll up the windows. You're all sealed inside. Take a good smell. Can you smell that? That was the great cologne experiment of 2004. You should not have gone with the dollar store for that one. Well, you can lose that old car smell by donating your vehicle to one of your favorite causes, like public radio. It only takes a few minutes, and just like that, you've supported this station, and well, you are on your way to a life of better smells.
Go to gpb.org/cars and thanks.
We're here with Melita Easters, Heath Garrett, and Jim Galloway for Political Rewind. I want to make a quick note here. Our friend Todd Rehm, who puts out Georgia Pundit every day, has really interesting items about this day in history going back. And I found one of those items, I just want to mention it briefly, today particularly interesting. You were talking about Republicans taking on some progressive issues in the legislature. He reminds us that even though Ellis Arnold, of course, was a Democratic governor, he was a progressive, and he went against the grain of conservative South. He signed legislation in 1945 that made Georgia, Jim, the first Southern state to eliminate the poll tax. And I thought that was particularly interesting.
And it's hard to believe that, yes, that was a liberal measure back in the day.
And it really was.
Well, I just wanted to bring that to everybody's attention because I did think, thank you for your great work on items like that, Todd Rehm. All right, let's talk just a little about the government shutdown that we have pending. Jim, the deadline is again Thursday night. There's an effort still to work out a compromise on the immigration issues, DACA in exchange for some form of funding for the wall.
The question is whether the David Perdue, Tom Cotton element to reduce legal immigration gets attached to that at all as well. Tweets from Donald Trump indicate that he wants that. It's as Senator Isaacson told us on Friday, he anticipates that another group, a large bipartisan group of senators, will probably reach at least an agreement in principle by Thursday, which would lend one to. And I don't think Democrats are going to force a shutdown. I think we're going to see another CR.
Let's listen for a moment here to one of the things that Johnny Isaacson told us about that on Friday.
There may be an opportunity to have an agreement in principle. That you an understanding in principle, but not the legislation itself.
So we're going to see another CR on February.
But maybe based on a platform of everybody understanding what the solution is.
You know, he's one of the things that I asked your friend Johnny Isaacson after he made that comment that there's an agreement in principle is whether we have any reason these days, whether you're a Democrat or a Republican, to have any faith in agreements in principle. We keep, you know, the majority leader Mitch McConnell keeps making these commitments to people whose votes he needs, and nothing seems to move forward. I'm not sure. An agreement in principle is going to get us toward much of an agreement other than a continuing resolution, right?
I think that's right. And I think that if you look back on what Leader McConnell really promised to move the last CR forward, it was a debate. Yeah. Bring to the floor the discussion of immigration, not solve it. You know, there's a kind of rule in politics that I've always believed that you're only going to get agreement when the self-interest of both parties dictates that there needs to be an agreement. Immigration is close to that, but what concerns me is there's also self-interest in the bases of both parties, a small minority in both parties who would rather run the 18 elections having this issue for their own benefit. The far left wants to run that all Republicans are anti-immigrant bigots, and the far right wants to run as if Democrats want to have open amnesty for the whole world to move to America. So
yeah, I think he's – I'm sorry, finish your thought.
So I think that if his self-interest lines up, I think we're right. We're going to end up with a continuing resolution, and then the debate goes in February, and we're so close to a good compromise here. The question is, can we get it?
Melita, I think it's right. The environment right now, the anti-Trump feeling that is so strong across the country, lends itself to our blaming Republicans for almost everything. But doesn't Heath make a good point that we have both parties entrenched on this, and with the exception of a very few members who are working on a compromise, people do want this as an issue to run on in the election cycle?
I agree that people do want it as an issue to run on, but then I think you also have one of the most compelling national stories came from here in Atlanta, the young priest at Christ the King, which is a congregation in the heart of Buckhead built over the former home of a Ku Klux Klan meeting spot. And that congregation has about 6,000 congregants and a young priest who's the only Catholic priest in the nation who is a dreamer. And you have staunch Republicans wanting that young man to continue to be their priest. And so I think there are these compelling storylines that change people's hearts, even though they may bleed Republican red, they have some brain telling them that maybe there's a side to the Democrat blue.
Jim, I think you're the one who reported the story of the priest at Christ the King, yes?
Well, it was a Washington Post story first.
Oh, okay.
And then Jeremy Redmond
okay.
with the AJC kind of did a little follow-up on it. But Melita's right. It's become well known, and I mean the point is that congregation is pretty much split on the issue of immigration, even with that priest there.
Yeah, Heath, what do you expect as a compromise moves forward? We now have there's a compromise that John McCain has worked on, which is interesting because in the last election cycle, he was fierce in saying the Arizona border needed to be strongly defended. But now he's working with Democrats on a compromise that, interestingly enough, would extend DACA protections for an even bigger group than what Trump has talked about, bigger than 1.8 million, because he'd date them back to, I think, 2013 or whatever, when there were
right.
more of them in the country even then, but doesn't say anything about the wall, doesn't say anything about the Purdue provisions, so-called chain migration, and the other the visa lottery, which Purdue's bill wants to eliminate.
Right.
How interesting that you've got people working on a compromise that just ignores what President Trump's called for.
Now, there's no question. Of course, that's a little bit the nature of the Senate, and Senator McCain's always been viewed as a maverick and will go out and create his own compromise sometimes. I do think that the whole compromise really centers around the extension of DACA, maybe not as far as McCain did, but Trump, remember, actually doubled the number of folks. So we got the majority of Republicans and a Republican president actually going further than any Republican administration ever has on the Dreamers, already on the table, public, in their statements. And what they're asking for in return is not an entire wall, but border security, some of which is a physical wall, some of which is a virtual wall around the border, and an end to chain migration, but not going as far as Senator Perdue and some other people might go in limiting it. So, everybody's getting 80% of what they want if we can get around this compromise. The question is, can they give up the 20% they're not getting? And I think that's what they're very close
on. I think family migration has become the issue.
Well, but you even have Vice President Pence. His family tree is a textbook example of what we're now calling chain migration.
Oh, you look at me. I'm an example of that. Yeah.
Right. And there's a good policy too, right? This is, the nation was, is now 330 million people, and it's a different world than it was 70 years ago when chain migration was a part of our economic policy.
All right, but what we've seen, Melita, is over and over again, the president, they get on track to do something, and then the president sends out a tweet that contradicts what he said a day earlier. If a compromise that doesn't have funding for the wall, specifically in it. President Trump is already being called Amnesty Don by the conservatives who look to him as the guy who's going to shut down immigration and send people back to their home countries. How is he going to refrain from attacking any proposal that doesn't give him some at least crumbs in terms of the wall that he talked about every single day on the campaign trail?
He has more Teflon than Ronald Reagan ever thought about.
Well, actually, Bill, I think that may be a better question for Heath here, because the question is, okay, who are Democrats going to be dealing with this on this? Are they going to be negotiating with Trump? I think they found out last time that that's a no-go. What they have to do is they're going to have to present Donald Trump with yet another bipartisan agreement, I think.
Well, and if you look at how the tax bill actually passed, it's when the White House kind of got out of the way and let the Senate and Paul Ryan and the House and others come forward with most of a compromise. There were probably some last-minute tweaks that the White House got to be involved in along with the Democrats, but that's where I think the work's being done, what Senator Isaacson was alluding to, why there's some hope that this could still be done. This working group it has enough people on the Democratic side and on the Republican side who I think can get something passed, both the House and the Senate. And then the question is, does the president take it as a victory? Because he has given Republicans some cover.
All right, let's look at the other side of this, Heath. How many continuing – I've lost track. Well, the question really is, when was the last time we actually had a budget that was put before members of Congress right. to vote on? It's all now continuing resolutions because of the inability of because first of the attachment of all sorts of controversial measures to the spending bill. What tell us, why is it a danger for the Congress to just operate on one continuing resolution after another?
Well, I think it's a danger for the country to be this, because you cannot invest and make the long-term investments you need to make in national security and infrastructure and the safety and security of our health and wellness, things like the CDC and others, right? It's hard to – the Port of Savannah, right? You're not going to really solve a 10-year funding problem by having continuing resolutions. You might by accident get to some of these things, but it's not allowing us as a nation to really plan and invest the way you have to do the things – nation, the leading nation in the world really needs to be able to do. Unfortunately, I don't see, and it's really, you can make an argument, as Senator Isaacson would say, it's a pox on both of our houses, Republicans and Democrats. This has been a problem. There's nobody has a supermajority in sight. So unless the political will of the nation starts to dictate through elections that both parties stop doing this, it seems to be the kind of order of the day under both Obama and now Trump.
I couldn't agree with Heath more. And I think what we have to move toward is slimmer margins for either party, controlling, dominating the other, so that those slimmer margins force more people from both the Democratic side and the Republican side to sit down at tables together and work for solutions. Because no business executive, whether he writes checks to Democrats or Republicans, would continue to work on temporary budgets without long-term planning. So Heath is absolutely right about the continuing resolution process.
And Jim, Melita makes the point, and every time we come up to the kind of point she just made, I feel like it's incumbent to point out that all of this goes back to gerrymandering. All of it. We don't have narrow margins because congressional districts, legislative districts around the country have all been set so that one party, in a case like Maryland, the Democrats have control, but in most states, Republicans dominate. So these, I just point out that again, these gerrymandering cases that are bubbling up now that the Supreme Court's going to look at later in the year have huge implications for the future of our
right.
politics.
Right. We've got at least one ruling to come down on by June 30th on, I believe it's the case in Wisconsin. Then we got a Maryland case. Then the North Carolina case, which is important. And I don't know if you noticed, the Supreme Court just upheld
Pennsylvania,
that Pennsylvania will have to run under redrawn lines.
Yeah, and Republicans tried to stop that.
That could determine control of the House in November.
Yep. All right, we got to get another break in. When we get back, let's talk a little Devin Nunes. Everybody else is. Why shouldn't we? This is Political Rewind.
In her new memoir, Irish writer Maggie O'Farrell describes her 17 brushes with death, including nearly being raped and killed, almost dying during labor, nearly drowning, and contracting encephalitis as a child. She wrote it in part for her daughter, who has a life-threatening immune disorder. Maggie O'Farrell on the next Fresh Air.
Join us for Fresh Air this afternoon at 3 here on GPB.
So the Devin Nunes memo was released to the public after getting a sign-off by the White House on Friday, just before we went on the air with our show. We had an opportunity to basically look it over and talk about it. But a lot happened this weekend, Jim Galloway, on both sides. Everybody's using it for fodder to prove their own point about whether or not justice at DOJ and FBI are corrupt and therefore operating against Donald Trump or for Trump. Before we talk about it, I wanted to play a little Sean Hannity here. And I picked it because it's a really strong example, I think, Jim, of exactly how the pro-Trump media forces are using the memo to try to undermine the entire investigation as well as the legitimacy of FBI and DOJ. Let's listen to what Hannity said on Friday night.
The FBI misled and purposely deceived a federal court while using an unverified, completely phony opposition research bought and paid for by Hillary Clinton to spy on an opposition campaign during a presidential election. Now, that type of abuse of power, that type of corruption, that shredding of the Constitution, it is unprecedented in American history. We have never, ever in history seen anything like this. Crimes have been committed. Comey, McCabe, Rosenstein, and others all need to be investigated, and in many cases prosecuted to the fullest extent of the law because these crimes have been committed.
All right. So a rant, and we get it. It's not an accurate rant, but what I thought was most interesting, McCabe's already gone. We know that. Mm-hmm. Comey's already gone. We know that. But Hannity includes Rod Rosenstein.
Right.
And Rod Rosenstein isn't gone yet.
He's the key to whether Robert Mueller keeps his job.
But he's under fire. So if you had any doubt that the Nunes memo is designed to continue to undermine the people in justice who Trump feels are enemies, I think Sean Hannity proved the point.
Yeah, it's number one, yeah, you're right. On Friday, we called the memo kind of a nothing burger. I'm willing to revise my opinion on that. I think it accomplished what it intended to do. And I think we have entered the era of the blue lie. And by that, I mean, we know what a white lie is. It's a polite lie you tell to your friends just to kind of for social lubrication. The black lie is the lie that you make for a personal aggrandizement, for greed, to benefit yourself. The blue lie is the lie that's sanctioned within your group because it is viewed as necessary to group survival.
Okay.
It is the lie that we permit ourselves when we're in an existential fight.
Yeah.
And that's where I think that the Trump supporters feel that they are in right now.
Heath, I don't know if you want me to use this expression word with you or not, but I've always thought of you as a moderate Republican, a sensible.
Wow. I've always preferred thoughtful.
All right.
Conservative, thoughtful conservative.
So how have you been feeling about what you've been hearing this weekend from Republicans?
So I think you have to compartmentalize the public policy questions here with the political. So let's start with the public policy. The House and Senate Intelligence Committees have, by and large, avoided the politicization of the last couple of decades, more so than the Foreign Relations Committees, the Armed Services Committee. They've all been politicized by Republicans and Democrats. I'm very concerned that this hyperpartisan now has bled over into the intel committees, and that's something we should not allow to have happen. However, if it's going to happen, it's going to happen in the House. Our founding fathers meant for it to be emotional and transient in this manner. So the mistake that I think that our House Republicans made is by not going ahead and releasing the Democratic side of the memo, because the sin of omit, maybe this is not really a lie, it's more of an omission of other facts that are now at least questioning the integrity of this memo. So if you're going to release the memo, then you should have released the other one, because it's going to get out anyway.
Well, and we should say that, in fact, the House Intelligence Committee is allegedly going to be taking a vote today on whether to release that Democratic memo. It will then, as did the Republican memo, go to the White House, and the president and his folks will have to sign off on its release, too. Melita, right. In a way, I asked Heath an unfair question, because while President Trump over the weekend said that this memo completely exonerated him, proved that the Russian investigation was a fraud to begin with, it does no such thing. And in fact, Republican leaders like Trey Gowdy went on the shows this weekend and said the Trump president's wrong. That investigation is still very relevant.
Well, Trey Gowdy basically said that he's now defending Robert Mueller, saying that the memo does not discredit the investigation. Paul Ryan is saying there's no connection between the memo and Rosenstein. And you have, I think it's extraordinary to have the commander-in-chief being the person who's trash-talking law enforcement and the FBI, and then to have other Republican leaders going behind the commander-in-chief with a circus elephant-sized broom to clean up the messes of his rhetoric. And regrettably, this is not the only time where responsible public servants have to clean up behind Trump's rhetoric.
Let us add that Trey Gowdy may feel a little bit freer this week than he felt last week.
But he still wants that federal judgeship.
That's right, because he's not running for re-election.
But Bill, I would say that the political side of this may have worked for Trump, right? The goal here for the Trump administration is not to win the debate, it's to muddy the debate.
I think you make an extremely good point.
And if you look at it from water cooler discussions to anecdotal evidence over the weekend to what I've seen from some focus groups, the average American is confused by the investigation and which part is. So yes, while insiders can bifurcate whether or not this has anything to do with Mueller, they're kind of done with it. They don't really believe that Russia caused Trump to win. They almost don't care if his son or somebody affiliated might have had some inappropriate meetings. They just kind of want to move on. I think this does muddy the water politically, and that's the point.
Yeah, and the Democratic problem is going to be that if their memo is released in the next 3 days, say 4 days, the damage is done. The Republican message has gotten out there, or the pro-Trump message. Let me be careful about that, not necessarily the entire party's message. And that's what's sticking. And the Democrats are going to be playing catch-up, and they're not going to be able to win the messaging war if they're playing catch-up, I don't think.
Well, Democrats can certainly learn from the great job Republicans have done in messaging over the last decade and a half.
Yeah. All right, well, we're going to watch.
I'll just laugh at that for a second.
All right. Jim, we've only got a couple minutes left. And in fact, I want all of you to get in on this because we all know a little bit about the person we're going to talk about. Tonight, we're going to be going to the second annual Zell Miller Institute dinner. It's something that his grandson, Brian Miller, put together, founded about a year plus ago, as a way to perpetuate his grandfather's messages, his philosophy of government, that sort of thing. And tonight, what's going to be interesting to me about it is that it's going to feature James Carville and Mary Matlin, the famous Batlin couple of politics of the last decade, not so much these days.
Right. We should mention that back in October, the Zell Miller's family announced that the former governor would be making no more public appearances. He's been kind of ravaged with a debilitating disease, a form of Parkinson's, I believe. And what's interesting about Carville's appearance is, of course, that in the 1990 governor's race, he served as Zell Miller's chief advisor, and that address to blue collar white Georgians and African American Georgians, that was the one that served as the blueprint for Bill Clinton's rise to the presidency.
It launched Carville's career.
It absolutely launched his career. We here in Georgia got to know him, those of us who covered politics before the country did. And Melita, you know, the famous story, and we're going to talk about it tonight. I've been asked to interview James and Mary for this, so I'm looking forward to that. But the famous story is that when Bill Clinton was exploring, Governor Clinton came in from Arkansas as he was exploring whether he was going to run for president in 92, he came to Georgia and he spent a night at the governor's mansion. And he and Zell stayed up late into the evening talking about politics, about the campaign. And allegedly, Clinton said, "Well, I need somebody to run my campaign." And Miller said, "You couldn't do better than James Carville and Paul Begala, who ran my 90 race." And as you say, that's really what launched Carville and Begala as major forces in national politics.
Absolutely. They owe him, so it's a good thing they're coming in to repay that debt and show respect.
Heath,
no question.
That was a fascinating. That was the campaign that featured Johnny Isaacson against Zell Miller in 1990, that first term. It was a fierce, fierce campaign.
And it was really the first time that a serious statewide Republican challenger had challenged the Democratic, you know, maintenance of power really since the Civil War in Georgia. And so it launched Johnny Isaacson's career, now, you know, Congress and the, you know, Senate, even though he lost. It definitely launched James Carville and Paul McGowan. They were a great team, masterful at what they did. And, you know, Zell and President Clinton were both geniuses in their own right. Political geniuses themselves, and so it was really a fascinating time to be in Georgia and to watch all of that happen. And the question is, can the Democratic Party of the 21st century and the 2020s replicate that, right? And or do they need to in Georgia? But and Republicans need to learn, you know, something from that as well, because they put together an interesting coalition.
And you know, Mary Matlin, it's not just about James tonight, Jim. Mary Matlin had interactions with Zell when he was appointed a U.S. senator from Georgia under George W. Bush, her candidate for president.
Right, and I think if I remember right, she has declared herself an independent at
yes,
this point.
Yes, yes. Right. They're not battling so much anymore.
Well, I tell you what, here's my suggestion. Back in the day, I'd say maybe before he spoke to the Republican National Convention, Zell Miller wrote a book, A National Party No More.
Yes.
And it was specifically pointed at Democrats. And I'm just wondering whether it can be just as well easily pointed toward Republicans today.
Oh, what a great point.
No, it's a great point.
All right. Well, I really looking forward to tonight's dinner and seeing. It's been a long time since we've seen Carville in these parts. It'll be fun to see him and his wife, Mary Matlin. That's it. We're out of time for today's show. Melita Easters, loved having you back in here today. Thank you.
We'll see you
throughout the campaign, I hope.
I hope so.
You got
so.
A lot of women to talk about this year.
I do. Just get me back and let me.
All right. We will. And Heath Garrett, we love having you in here, too. Thank you so much for being with us. Jim Galloway, we're going to head to Savannah, hit the road to Savannah probably Thursday morning and be there for the show that night. In the meantime, we're back with a Political Rewind on Wednesday at 2 Two-Way Street. On Thursday at 2, we just got all sorts of exciting things going on. Thank you for being here, Jim.
Enjoyed it again.
Always. All right. Thank you to Olivia Rheingold and Tom Faust for your work on the show. I'm Bill Nigut. See you again on Political Rewind Wednesday at 2.